Welcome to the Rethinking Revenue Podcast, where CEOs, revenue leaders, investors, and go-to-market experts share hard-fought lessons of success and failure as they've prepared their businesses to evolve beyond the status quo. Now, let's meet your co-hosts, Ed Porter and James Roris. Ed is a fractional chief revenue officer and founder of Blue Chip CRO. He helps CEOs fix revenue problems inside marketing, sales, and customer success teams. James is a CRO's secret weapon, creator of Wins Selling. He helps revenue leaders simplify sales success by developing cross-functional go-to-market teams and establishing certified sales pipelines. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another episode of Rethinking Revenue. This is going to be an action-packed week with James and I. We have been excited to get this podcast launched and getting a lot of guests going. And James sent me a text message last night. He's like, dude, we got seven people this week. So we got a good week. So this is exciting for me, but certainly got to take a step back and make sure that I'm aligning with your calendar. So James, sorry, but excited. And on the upside, we get to see a lot of each other, which I know is probably the highlight of your week.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Especially given that we're going to chat with Brad next, who's got a really cool biz.
Yeah, and a really cool last name that aligns to, you know, potentially some of our lifestyle, James.
Yeah.
All right. So on that note, welcome Brad Gamble from The Selling Factory. Brad, tell us a little bit about you, the company, the clients you serve.
Hey, Ed and James. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Just so you know, I do have the last name Gamble, but I'm a horrible gambler. So it hasn't helped me at all.
Good for you, man. Stay away. Yeah. That's smart.
So I'm co-founder and CEO of The Selling Factory. We're a seven-year-old company now based in Gainesville, Florida. And we hire 100% college students as our workforce to do outsourced sales support and lead generation for companies across the globe. We've had about 1,000, we just crossed 1,000 students that have worked for us over the last 7 years in fractional sales support, part-time SDR type roles. And we've worked with probably about 160 companies over the last 7 years now and learned a ton, learned certainly what not to do, probably more so than what to do. But it's just been a fantastic ride, especially getting to work with the next generation of career professionals that are going to be entering the workforce here soon.
And you're offloading a huge responsibility for hiring managers who really maybe haven't invested the amount of time that you have in understanding the next generation and the generations that will come after.
Yeah, absolutely. I in my former career in the energy business, I ran a large inside sales presence and an outside sales presence. And, you know, we had sales reps that were anywhere from 25 to 55 to 60 years old. But now it's really that 18 to 23 year old that works for us. And so, yes, it has opened my eyes completely to the next generation and what we have. And I'm very happy. I'm very excited about it, which is the good news of the next generation that's going to be entering the workforce.
Well, maybe you can, and I've got lots of thoughts about the younger generation. I mean, I love the energy and inspiration and creativity. I think the biggest challenge for especially older managers is just how unfamiliar that generation is, or younger generations are to us, right? And we default as leaders to relating well to folks who are like us, you know? So I wonder, maybe you can talk more about the value proposition that you bring to the organizations that work for you or work with you. I'm really curious about what you found to be most compelling.
Yeah, what we've realized is that, you know, the job of somebody in an entry-level role in sales is very difficult. It involves cold calling, research, getting rejected all the time. And what we've found is that students realize how critical those skills are to be able to do that, how much they learn, and what it means to have that on their resume or their LinkedIn profile, that they did this kind of work early in their life. And so what's nice is that we get students that want to do this work. And versus oftentimes you don't have people that want to do that work. It's usually a transition type of role. So sales managers or SDR managers at companies deal with massive turnover and having to really just get people to do this type of work, which is very difficult. And it's really been fun managing individuals, students that want to do the work. And because of that, and because they're working part-time and not getting burned out, they're working 10 to 12 hours per week, we really get their best effort for those 10 to 12 hours a week. So it's like you're getting a super rep in a sense by building a team at the Selling Factory. And last thing I'll say is it's nice when you talk about bad habits and good habits that people have when they come to work. Well, our students really have no habits. You're actually getting you're getting your first crack at molding somebody's work ethic and resilience as they're doing this type of job.
Yeah, it's outstanding. And that must speak a lot to the training that you put them through, which I imagine is pretty robust. I'm thinking of past conversations with Ed, Ed asking the question, why would you have a $250,000 or $300,000 or $500,000 a year rep cold calling, right? Why wouldn't you have that type of support? But we've seen a lot of holes in the traditional SDR model, which you alluded to, right? This idea that, hey, it's a transitional role. It's something that people really don't want to be doing. They want to be doing something else ideally. How do you get max performance out of those folks? So I'm curious, when you think about your client and the topic for today, this idea of rethinking revenue, what kind of a mindset or trigger event or thought process do your ideal clients have to have in order for them to be open to this opportunity?
So we've seen an unbelievable change the last 7 years, even since we've been running this company, where I studied a lot of the predictable revenue model and mm-hmm. really building teams of SDRs that were handling maybe four or five steps of, call it that 10-step selling process with that handoff to an AE. And we built our model around that early on. And what we found was that over time, first off, it was difficult to get part-time students to be able to do as much as a full-time SDR would be expected to do. And so what we started doing is really just focusing on what they are good at, which is making those early stage calls, doing that initial research, and really honing in on very specifically what we can do to help a client, which is really, it's almost like SDR light in a sense. Yeah. And so it's, I don't know if it's coincidence or what, the market has changed, and we've seen a lot of the death of the SDR type of talk. And do companies have the ability to have these $500,000 SDR teams, or in some cases $1 million SDR teams? And we've seen really, even at with a lot of the roles that our graduates are going into, a lot of those SDR roles are starting to get pulled back. And so that's been happening in parallel to what our business has been going through. And what we've seen is really the downsizing of what your traditional SDR would do, really making it to more, it's, for lack of a better word, I've called it an AE assistant or an account executive assistant, to where there's still going to be that early stage work that has to be done. But I think that, and we can talk about this later on, but I really think there's going to be a lot of pushback from the AE community saying, well, guess what? Now you no longer have an SDR. You have to make cold calls. That's going to be a tough pill for them to swallow, most of them at least.
Yeah. Well, I think I remember chatting with you earlier about this. And back in the day when I was training older, veteran reps on technology, right? Trying to move them off their daytimers to their new CRM system, right? We got a lot of resistance when change came. And for a lot of clients, the solution was, hey, let's just get them assistance. We're going to fill out the CRM for them. We're not going to make them get over that hurdle. I think it's wise to be open to change and open to new ways of thinking about this stuff, especially if you can make that AE more productive and help them make more money. Why wouldn't they embrace it? And why wouldn't you do it if you could lower your cost of sales by hiring somebody who's well-trained? You're outsourcing the management. I don't have to become an expert on all the various ways that your folks are identifying leads, doing the research, all that stuff. You can be the specialist that comes in and learns, make sure you're learning how to leverage the latest technology, et cetera, to make that happen. And I can just outsource to make my reps more productive. Sounds like a win to me. I'm curious, what types of businesses are best suited for the service that you provide?
So we made a pivot about 2 years ago. 2 years ago, maybe actually about 3 years ago, we were in the camp of we want to be everything to everybody. So we would have a $200 million cybersecurity company that we were doing lead generation for, and a consumer goods startup that we were doing lead generation for. which is really difficult to have focusing on one particular industry or just having so many different industries that you're trying to learn about at the same time. So we started to realize that we weren't having success, or at least the success that we wanted, our clients wanted, in that big enterprise space. So multi-channel outreach, whether it's phone, email, LinkedIn, it just didn't suit us and suit our students well. That really takes a full-time SDR to do that type of work. So we really slimmed it down and said, okay, well, where are we having the most success? And we're having the most success with clients that were selling into the SMB space. So your brick and mortar, independent retailers, small manufacturing, places that had a front door, a physical front door, that had a phone line that somebody would answer. And so we started to really, and this was part of the selling process we did when we were talking to new potential prospects, was that if you're looking for us to reach out to Fortune 500s or C-suite at $100 million companies kind of stuff to try to book meetings, that we're not the right fit for you. And we actually took a stand, and I do the majority of the selling for the company, and I took a stance of, I'm going to try to talk you out of hiring us, because I don't want to put us in a situation where we're going to sign a contract, we're going to work for 90 to 120 days, you're going to be unhappy, and then we're going to part ways. I didn't want to do that anymore. So we really started focusing on those companies, like consumer goods companies that sell into mom and pop stores, or consumer services that sell into commercial businesses, insurance companies, energy companies that sell to restaurants, hotels, small manufacturers, places like that. It really changed our business, because we just stuck to what we were really good at and then focused there and stayed away from those gigantic companies or those companies trying to sell into gigantic companies.
What was the, going back to the part, what got you to think about that like that? So you said this 3 years ago and you looked at the customers you were successful with, but what spawned that rethinking or that pivot?
It was really just the churn rate. I mean,
Client churn.
I mean, we did a really good job of being transparent, but also saying, look, we're gonna launch a team. We got a bunch of really smart, talented students that are eager to get on the phone. That sounds really good. Most people say, yes, I want that. So what changed was I was tired of losing customers or trying something out for 3, 4, 5 months and then saying it's not working. Now, some of that is client expectation and making sure that those are that's something that you can mutually agree upon and what expectations are going to be. A lot of companies think that if I sign on with an outsourced sales team, all my problems go away and all of a sudden it's going to be raining contracts, and rarely does that happen. But we were super confident in this, the minority of our business, of our portfolio clients, that we were having just success over and over and over again. So we said, let's get rid of the other side and then focus on this side, which is hard to do when you need revenue, you need profit to run your business. So saying no to these customers that are willing to say yes because you know it's not going to be a good fit was really hard for us to do, but we did it and just focused on the customers that we knew that we would give them a average or better than average product than they had.
What did that mean to your company in terms of a strategy to then go find customers like that? What all had to change as you were starting to model out what a good customer looks like and then kind of do your own work, right? I mean, you're the outsourced lead gen for clients. So how did you do your lead gen? So going back into what did that look like in changing your go-to-market strategy once you define that new ICP?
So we've tried a multitude of marketing strategies. We've done LinkedIn marketing or LinkedIn ads. We've done Google ads. And they've been okay, but the problem was that it was really hard to find that company that was in our area of expertise, selling it to SMB, and then actually have them realize that they have a need to outsource this type of work. So it's just such a small percentage of companies that actually would entertain this idea. What we've realized is that our best method of new client acquisition is word of mouth. So the vast majority of our customers, or our clients that we get now, are referrals and word of mouth. And we're okay with that. So we don't spend much of anything on marketing. We've built up such a name now after 7 years that we get inbounds just saying, hey, this company over here, I know Joe at this company, and I know Sarah over here, and they said that you're awesome. Would love to talk to you. And that's been fantastic. But we have not poured a lot of resources into marketing or advertising.
I love that. There's so many businesses are moving away from, right, the idea of word of mouth, because it's somewhat uncontrollable, or that we view it as uncontrollable. When's that next referral going to come in, and how qualified would that referral be? How have you overcome those challenges and made that more predictable and repeatable for the biz?
So all new meetings come through me, and sometimes through one of my business partners, Ian as well. And we just have a conversation to start, and we're willing to invest a 30-minute conversation with really any company that reaches out to us. So it might mean I have 10 meetings a month. It might mean I have 20 meetings a month. But just having that initial conversation, really getting a feel for, are we going to be a right? That is the number one thing that I'm doing when I'm meeting with a new company is, do I believe that we can actually help them and get them a good return on what they're going to spend with us? Because I do not want to work with them if I don't believe that we can do that. And that's really served us well, because if somebody's coming to you through cold outreach, it's funny. It's like what we do with the Selling Factory would not be a good client for the Selling Factory. So we really have to hone in on what they're trying to do, where they're trying to get to, the tools they have, and do we think that the solution that we provide with our teams of students is that going to make them happy? And if I feel confident in that, we'll move forward. But the nice thing about the referrals is that you're already getting that third party validation from somebody else that they trust. It's not me hitting you up out of the blue saying, hey, would you like to outsource your lead generation to a bunch of college students? We don't have to go across that barrier.
Yeah, I love that. And the one thing that you mentioned this a couple of times, but one thing you're making me think about is how important qualification is for you guys. In your biz, I can imagine there's a level of desperation for a lot of clients. You know, leads are important. Filling the pipe is important. What I'm doing isn't working, or it's not working well enough. It's too expensive. I can't scale. And there's there would be a tendency without the discipline to take those clients that aren't ideal for you, right? Trade cash for that reputation, et cetera. I think there's a lot of businesses that could learn from that. Can you talk more about that as a strategy or a strategic decision and what it's meant for the organization?
Yeah, it's the natural just cycle of, I guess, maturation of a business. When you start a business, just like when we did, we weren't sure what we were good at, especially of a service business. So we had to say yes to everybody. One, because we needed to make money. We had to have some kind of revenue coming in. But we didn't know what was going to work and what wasn't going to work. And it took us probably 4 years to really nail down where we can provide the most value, where we can have the least amount of churn, where we can satisfy the most customers. And so as I'm having meetings with new potential clients, I really am looking for reasons for them not to hire us. So I do two things. One is I'm looking for reasons for them not to hire us. And two, if I'm starting to get the feel that this is a desperation move on their part, or they just that they think this will be the magic that will make their business grow, I start pivoting towards, what other options do you have? Let's leave this call with some kind of value. We're probably not going to be a good fit, but let's talk about the other strategies that you can leave this call with that you could think about. And it blew my mind how that resonated with people. One, you leave every conversation on a positive note. Two, I mean, and so many of them said, I cannot believe you're saying this to me right now. I assume you're trying to pitch me on your company and get me to sign up with you. And I'm going, I'm not. I'm too old for that. I'm tired of disappointing people. But we really want to make sure that they're leaving that conversation with some kind of value. And actually what spawned from that are more referrals. Them telling their people in their network, hey, I met with this company. It wasn't a good fit for us, but you got to meet them. They're super transparent. Just give them a call, set up a meeting with them and see. So that's been, we get a lot of referrals from people that we never worked with because of that. So it's been a great lead gen for us on its own.
Plus, you you're protecting your reputation because you're only working with folks you're likely to be successful as. So you're moving closer and closer toward that 100%, you know, satisfied customer base, which is fantastic.
Yeah. Closer to 100%, not 100%.
Yeah, they're closer. That's the key word. And that's, you know, I love the thing you said about you're trying to find the reasons why not. And I like that approach a lot better than trying to find the reasons why so, because it prevents so many things. And the clarity is ultimately what we want to get in sales, is we want clarity on whether this is moving forward or whether it's not. And by having that approach, I feel like you're trying to find reasons why not, and try to find those reasons why it doesn't make sense, that should get you to more of the yes or obviously no. But I like that approach a lot better. So that's I want to dive into that a little bit. Was that way in the beginning? Did you, as you evolved as a salesperson, sales leader, is that something that you just, as you talked to a lot of clients and started to have some experiences, how did you form that process that you're now employing in this try to find reasons why not?
I'm trying to think of when that happened. It was probably a year and a half to 2 years ago. And I wrote some LinkedIn posts about this back then, with the idea of try to get them to not buy from you as a sales tactic or just a sales mindset. And what I found is that by doing that, it really lowers everybody's guard. Because if you're going into a selling situation, guard is up, arms are crossed, you're so careful about giving up information if you're the prospect, and you're always on high alert that they're going to try to just ram you into some kind of contract. And it causes a lot of tension. And so I think by taking that mindset of try to get them to not buy from you, really has caused more people to want to buy from us if it's a good fit. Now, where I have to be careful is if I know it's a really good fit and I'm like, oh my gosh, we would crush it for this company. I don't want to then be too eager and say, oh my gosh, we're going to be amazing. You're going to love it. Your return on investment is going to be 10x. Let me send you a contract, because then you can go back into that tension mode again. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I've had to struggle with, or I've struggled with, is maintaining my composure. And even when I think it's going to be a home run, and just let the process play out.
Yeah. So that is my exact definition of word vomit, is when a salesperson hears something that they latch onto and just bleh, and then you just crush any opportunity you have. So good. Good for you, Brad. You are not word vomiting. You are, or at least in most cases, I haven't listened to your sales calls, but you have the full wherewithal about with that, which is great. So good. Don't word vomit.
Yeah. Love that. Well, it sounds like, I mean, what we're doing here is we're talking about selling without selling, right? It's much more around how do we help you buy or make the right buying decision or the successful buying decision versus how do we sell you something? But I also love, Brad, this, the validation of what we all hope would be true. If it's the right company, but the wrong time, or just the wrong company and right time, whatever gets us to the no is understood and respected, and you're still leaving with a relationship that has value. So it's the ultimate, to me, it's the ultimate validation of the servant leader mindset when you bring that to sales, right? We're not just thinking about serving ourselves. We're not just thinking about using force or manipulation or other toxic types of approaches to win deals. We're actually living up to the standards set by our brand and operating in a functional way that creates growth and multiplies value on both sides of the equation.
Yeah, it's well said, James. And I still want to reiterate that's really hard to do in the beginning. When you're starting a business, to have people are thinking, oh, well, it's easy for you to say you have a business that's 7 years old, and well, we didn't know that year one. We didn't know that till probably year four. And so in the beginning, you have to take those jobs that you don't know how they're gonna work out. Yeah, you have to take ones that you think might be a nightmare, because one, you need revenue, and two, you have to learn what doesn't work. So it's a process, it takes some time. But you can get there, and the faster you can get there, the more successful your company will be.
Yeah. So let's talk about The mantra of our show of rethinking revenue, and I think we've talked about this. You mentioned this pivot in a couple things. One, from a different ideal customer profile, as well as even talking about this selling style that's evolved over the years. So those are pretty I would consider pivotal changes. One is redefining, and the other is how you sell and how you get better. And so, given those two. And this could be part of that process, or it could be something else altogether. Is there anything in the 7 years that you've been at it to even more recently where you've kind of had to look at the external environment or any external factors that are happening and think about, what do I got to do for my clients, my employees, my business? Any others that have required you to think differently about your go forward plan? Again, you mentioned the two, but anything else beyond that?
Yeah, when I was in the energy business, I was VP of sales of a company that was doing $500 to $600 million a year in revenue. And then I was at that company for 15 years and then started this business, the Selling Factory, in 2017, late 2016. And I think what I've realized is, being a business owner of a small business versus an executive at a very large business, is how overhead, payroll cost, technology spend, it's unbelievable how fast that can get out of control. And I think that, and one realization I had is, you really have to erase your thoughts of going from big company, big budgets, big spend, to very small company, small budget, small spend, which means that, and we made a lot of mistakes with this over the years, where we assumed that you had to have an office space, you had to have people in person, you had to have camaraderie and collaboration. Now we realize you don't. So there goes the cost of a lease or a mortgage or the cost of overhead of having a physical office space. We assume that there's a certain manager to rep ratio that had to be the case. You know, you think, okay, you should never manage more than 10 people or whatever the number might be. Well, coming from big corporate environments, big teams, that's probably the case. Well, in our model, we have fractional students. Some of that bled over into, we assume that one manager could only manage maybe 15 part-time students. Well, what we've realized now is that by streamlining what we're doing, focusing on just a few different industries, one manager could manage 40 students or 45 students, which is huge if you're talking about the payroll of a management staff. And so that's really been one of the biggest things that I've seen, certainly over the last year, but even the last couple of years now, is your overhead and running a sales operation. I mean, we had a $4 million sales operation in the energy business. And now we have probably a $500,000 sales operation, $600,000 sales operation. Everything is especially when you get to it, when you're in a small business or you're trying to be profitable, every single dollar counts. So you have to make sure that every single dollar has a home on the expense side. That's really been eye opening for us the last year or so.
It's outstanding. It's also a testament to, it must be a testament to the training that you put these folks through. I mean, you did mention earlier that they don't come to you with any bad habits, but my sense is the only way that you can create that kind of leverage from a management perspective is everybody is practicing a very predictable, repeatable approach, all in the same way, using the same language, vocabulary, all with the same expectations, etc., and reinforcing that as often as you need to support the infrastructure you've built. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we used to do in-person training with our students. We moved to virtual training, live virtual training, and we have now moved to completely self-guided training from really the time that they apply to the Selling Factory. They do have a live interview with one of our student leaders. And then if they are onboarded, they then go through a training process that is video based. It has quizzes, it has check-ins. And once they get through that training process, it's paid training, paid all the way through. And then when they are ready to join a team that's supporting a client, then they come to one of our campaign managers really ready to go. There's no describing what a script is or what a proposal is or what an objection is. They've already been through that. They've been tested through that. And so now that really helps our campaign managers so that when they have new members joining the team, they're already starting with somebody that, yes, they have no good habits or bad habits, but they understand what they're going to be doing. So then it's just focus on who is the client that you're going to be representing? What is their goal? What are their goals? What are you going to be doing on a day-to-day basis? And to your point, James, doing a lot of the same things over and over again really helps us from a scalability standpoint to bring on hundreds of students every year to be able to support our clients, because so much of it is repetitive. And that makes it a lot easier from a management perspective, which has allowed us now to have a lower manager to rep ratio.
Well, Brett, we could go on. I think what's really cool is that you bring two perspectives, right? The idea of helping your clients rethink revenue, as well as having built your business over the last 7 years and how you've had to rethink revenue. Great insights. If there was one thing you could leave, one bit of advice you could leave with an entrepreneur, I'm going to ask you for both, as well as a piece of advice you could leave with a P&L owner, or revenue leader at a company that you serve, what kind of advice would you give them each to be thinking about how to achieve their goals? Maybe look or consider different ways to achieve those goals.
Yeah, for the entrepreneur, I would say if you're going to start a business, build a product, start a company that has a service of some kind, go where the margin is. Pick high margin stuff. Come up with ideas that give you enough profit margin to be able to not only pay yourself something, run your business, but then eventually hire people. And I do one of those, if I were to start a business again, kind of things, I would be, okay, what's something that has a 90% profit margin? Let's start there. So yeah, high margin wins. Also for the entrepreneur, check your expenses every single month. You look at things like tech bloat, tech platforms that you're subscribing to. Do you even need that anymore? That little $150 a month thing that you're buying on a subscription basis, if you haven't used it in 90 days, get rid of it. Go month to month. Don't do the annual plan. The savings are not worth it to, in my opinion, to do annual plans. So those are my two big things for entrepreneurs. For revenue leaders, what I would say is there's a lot of, and you read it all the time on LinkedIn, there's a lot of bad publicity for the next generation that is joining the workforce. And I'm sure that there are people out there, a lot of them, that maybe just graduated college or didn't go to college, that are trying to enter the workforce that are either they think they're worth more than they are, they don't show up on time, they don't know how to make good eye contact or be leaders, whatever it might be. You just read a lot about this now. And I was thinking about it, and I've been in business now for 25 years. And I feel like every generation, the older generation's complaining about them. So this is nothing new. But what I'll say is that for the students that we're seeing that are coming through, that are graduating, they are motivated. They are curious. They want to be part of something new. They want to build a network. They want to provide value, and they want to receive constructive feedback. They want to know how they're doing. And so I would tell revenue leaders, be very open to this next generation that's coming up, because from what we've seen with our graduates that have moved on to companies, they're becoming stars. So the future's bright.
That's great. Outstanding. Thank you.
That's great. Yeah, those are two pieces of great advice. The margin thing is, I started my career in the outsourced call center, and that's how we were trained. And I'm fortunate because that's been at the foundation of a lot of things that I look at. So kudos to you. Obviously you're in this business too, but for realizing that. So that's awesome. You know, before we close out, I have one thing I want to kind of shout out real quick. And Brad, I want you to have some time to chat about this, because I think what you're doing at Selling Factory is really awesome. So can you take the audience through more about what the networking workshops are that you're doing with the students? And I want to talk about that briefly, maybe if you could in like 2 minutes or less, but I want to give a shout out to that because I think it's extremely unique. It's absolutely needed in the industry, and it's the right time at a person's career when they're in college or just about to graduate from college and get into the working world where they need to learn these networking skills. So in a couple minutes, can you just kind of summarize what that is or what you're doing?
As I mentioned, we've worked with about over a thousand students now at the Selling Factory, and we've always sold our services to businesses and then hired students to complete the jobs that are required. We've never really, outside of some training sessions here and there, we haven't really built a product for students. And so we did that this last year. And the reason why we did that is we did a survey of our alumni that were 1 to 3 years into their career. And we asked them, what do you wish you learned in college that you did not learn in college? And the number one answer they gave was how to build a professional network. And so me and my business partner started kind of mulling on this idea, and we came up with a workshop, a 5-week workshop called Actionable Networking. And this process and this framework that we've developed guides college students through the process of researching interesting industries and companies, finding people at those companies, reaching out to those people with an invitation to meet, get together, get some advice from them, having those meetings, and then providing ongoing value as time goes on with your new network that you're developing. And there's this natural fear that most college students have that LinkedIn is intimidating. Business professionals wouldn't want to talk to me. I'm just a student. What value can I really provide? And what we found is that professionals really want to help the next generation. They take pride in that. That's a lot of value that they get. So response rates from outbound emails and connections that our students are sending going through our framework have been astronomically high. And what's come out of that is students are getting job offers that they didn't know existed. They're getting internship opportunities. But more than anything, their confidence is soaring that they can actually build a network while they're still in college. So we did some test workshops and pilots last year. This year, we're launching it really big. We want to get as many college students into this as possible. ActionableNetworking.com is the website. And we're about to release our spring workshop schedule here pretty soon. And we expect that this could impact. I mean, there's 4.3 million college graduates each year, and every single one of them should take this workshop.
That's awesome. I love that. I love that for so many reasons. And when you posted about it, I was like, this is sweet. So yeah, thank you for calling that out for a little bit. And hopefully the listeners can take that and look at that, go to that website, check it out. I would argue too, there's a lot of people beyond college students that need this too. And whether it's new to the career or just furthering your education. So I like the focus, of course, but I think it's relevant to a lot of different people. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for your time, Brad. This has been an awesome session. Let's close out real quick with where can people find you and the Selling Factory, and how can people connect?
Sure. And thanks again for having me, Ed and James. This has been awesome. So I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. You can look up Bradley Gamble on LinkedIn. You can follow the Selling Factory and Actionable Networking on LinkedIn. And then our websites are simply theSellingFactory.com and ActionableNetworking.com. And would love to, I set a goal this year that I want to meet 251 new people, not in a selling situation. So that's the challenge I'm throwing down for myself. And I already have a spreadsheet built for it. So ready to meet.
Nice. That's a great goal. Good deal. Well, awesome. Well, thank you again, James, as always. It's great to see your face. I know the audience can't, so sorry for them, but good
soon,
to see
man.
You, Brad.
We'll be in the camera.
Yeah, Brad, thanks for time. And for everyone else, tune in to the next episode, and we will see you on the flip side.